to WWBC Coco Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco Rockledge and W264AS Rockledge Melbourne, Palm Bay, and 100.7 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coast. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and we're also heard on the World Wide Web on WWBC.
That's right, 1510 WWBC.com. You can hit that listen live button and get us on any one of your streaming devices. Of course, after the show, we have a download section right there on demand. You can get any one of our shows downloaded by date. You just look for the Monday 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time slot for Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And then, of course, we share all of that on our social media channels, which is Viewpoint with Sita and Friends and SitaMediaInc.com, which is also our website.
That's right. And, you know, for our listeners who are tuning in today for the first time, just want to give you a quick shout out to all our sponsors who sponsors our shows and help us to stay on air. And for the listeners who are tuning in for the first time, we sit here on Mondays, Ellen O'Neill, Ali Tambor, myself, and Danny Whiting, and we talk about kitchen table topics. What we like to say is things that are going on around the nation, right here in Brevard County, Florida, around the world. I think all of us understand as we get older, bolder, and wiser, that it is our responsibility, within reason, of course, to leave the world a better place than we found it. Correct, Allie?
Absolutely. Plus, it brings us all together. It makes the world a little smaller, but that's a good thing.
It does. And, you know, Ellen, I see you, you know, when you're out singing your heart out, you are singing to so many people of different nationalities, different races, different cultures. And I sometimes feel as wherever you're singing, you're bringing so much joy and making our world a better place as well.
Well, and that's what it's all about, just like what you talk about leaving a better footprint. And we just have different vehicles, right? Mine's with music and making memories with people and having fun out there. And yours, you know, you've been an advocate for a long time for the people that don't have a voice or need an extra voice, and certainly for creating peace and unity. I mean, you speak the namaste. You act it out every single day.
Well, you know, I think our childhood, the way we were raised, has a lot to do with our outlook on life.
I agree.
And, you know, I grew up with, as you know, in a village, 18 brothers and sisters with, you know, a lot of stepsisters, stepbrothers, moms, dads, whatever. And it seems as though every single social issue that people are facing in their life at some time, I've been through it. Mm-hmm. You talk about domestic violence, we had it.
Yeah.
You talk about bullying, we had it. You talk about poverty, we had it. You talk about,
illnesses.
No shoes for school, walking bare feet.
Yep.
We had it. You talk about my dad having to arrange marriages for some of the daughters and me begging to go to elementary school and high school and then nursing school. I did it. So anything people throw at me, I can come back in a nice way and say, hey, stop. I've lived through it. And I mean, even in my nursing career, I see the elderly. And, you know, I see things. So it's good. It's good in a way. So for our listeners who are tuning in today, on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, our show is fun. It's unscripted. It's fairly balanced. And we give out valuable information to our listeners, whether they want to write a book, become a writer, an author. Maybe they want to open a business, go to a bank, open a bank, whatever it is you want to do. Financial literacy, run for office. You want to save the whales. You want to advocate for clean air, water, and sunshine, we're here. And today's no different. On our second segment, we've got a gentleman calling in from Los Angeles, California. His name is John Shavitz, and he actually is from Baltimore, Maryland, and he's going to be calling in to talk about a film that he made as a single dad, and it's called what is it? Roses?
The vine.
The roses on the vine. All right. And then our first segment is with a very lovely lady that I had the pleasure of speaking with. And she's on the phone. And I think, Jenny Ahmad, you're on the phone. And we're going to talk a little bit with you about your book, retirement, being a grandma, and like me, all these things that are happening in life. And you've written books, Jenny, about science fiction, political thrillers, and boy, you do grab the readers. So welcome to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and I know you're on the phone, so take it away.
Well, thank you for having me, Sita. I write a lot, and it's been a hobby of mine for many years. I grew up on a farm in the South, and we had a 500-acre farm, so there was, like, no neighbors. And my only thing that I used to have was I had three horses. We had, I think, 9 dogs, and I don't remember how many cats we had, but we had a lot of cats. We had a billy goat and a peacock, and those were my friends growing up.
But you know what? But in today's world, you know what? People would give anything to have a life like that right now.
Yeah.
That's true. Absolutely. But when you're a kid, you don't understand that. It's like, okay, I'm here all alone.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the village in Trinidad and Tobago, you know, my mother would take us outside to pick lemons, and then we would, you know, slice the lemons, make lemonade. We would eat sugar cane. We slept on mattresses made with coconut fiber. We had a little house that we would use cow dung and mud to smoothen the surfaces downstairs. Mm-hmm. And you would see people with stuff that they quote-unquote bought in a store. And we'd be like, oh, God, one day we'd be rich like that and we'd be able to buy something in a store, you know? And then you grow up and then you're like, wait a minute, people are paying big bucks to go and live and spend time in a village and have that life that we left behind. But it was not easy, you know?
You know, I'm Gen X. So I grew up in the time where your parents threw you out of the house during the day and they didn't see you until those streetlights came on. I drank from the hose and, you know, it's like stuff like this doesn't happen today. When I was growing up at 10 o'clock, there used to be a public service announcement. It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
I remember that.
So Jenny, so you lived on the farm. You had the peacock as your friend. I could just see that little picture in front of me, and you're beautiful, by the way. I saw the picture you sent for me. Thank you for giving back so much. Your career, you were an ICU and ER nurse, a degree in genetics. I mean, you went back to school and you did so many things. So talk to us about how you were able to take your career and take all that knowledge and experience and put it into writing.
Well, one thing that I do in life, and it's really crazy. I've been doing this since I was very young. I do two things every day. I want to learn something new. And the second thing is I always do something mindless before I go to bed, whether that's crocheting, Sudoku puzzles, whatever it is, it's got to be mindless and not cause me any stress. So I do that every day. I do those two things. And actually, one time I read this article that said 47% of households is run by the women. They're like single mothers. So 47% of households were women run. And I thought about that, and it's like, wow, because I always liked reading dystopian novels, and I thought to myself, you know, this is one part of the population that's been totally ignored because it's male-dominated. And so what I did is my first book is called Tough Mama Survival. And what I did is I put down in that book, I geared it for women. What do you do when the worst happens? Well, we've all gone through COVID, so we know the worst can happen. It doesn't have to be man-made or anything. And I think of it as insurance. If you know what you need and you have your stock of food and everything, consider that insurance because you never know. I mean, look at what the price of eggs is now, $11. Think of the people that are happy to have one or two chickens in their yard. So what I did is I focused my book just on women, you know, and I listed things you can do if something medical happens and if help isn't coming, what do you do? So those are things I put down. You could also take the FEMA runs, like free classes on radiation, understanding radiation and stuff like that. So that's what I put in that book. And that little say is went to number one on Amazon. And it's
yeah, I love the name of the book. It's A Tough Mama's Guide to Survival. But, but you know, you hit the nail on the head, because I firmly believe that behind every successful man is a woman with two hands that's moving the neck.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, because even I mean, we give birth to the children, and I remember this so distinctly, that once you give birth, you are in survival mode to set up that nursery, right? To set up the changing table, a crib, crib sheets, the children, and the mother sometimes, most of the times, we're the ones from day one who are doing it. But I remember when my mom gave birth to my siblings, we didn't have a nursery. The kids slept wherever there was a little space, you know? And she would have to have a couple of pillows for when she gets home to block the baby. We didn't have money for a playpen. We didn't have money to buy wood to make a playpen. And the thing is, I remember my mother being in survival mode with the cooking and the washing and, you know, the clothesline and the baby and diapers and formula and breastfeeding. And I always thought, boy, she was such a survivor that she instilled it in us. But now I live in the United States, and it's happening. Woman here, the single woman, the married woman, it's always on our shoulders.
Yes, it is. You know, it's that difference between what you were just mentioning. It's that little hormone called oxytocin that gives us that nesting and mothering. You know, men don't have that. They have an abundance of testosterone. They're the protectors, the hunters, the gatherers. And, you know, the women are behind the scenes. But, you know, women need to come out of behind the scenes, especially if 47% of the women are running their household. They need to be actually the combination. They need to know what to do and how to do it.
Right. And we're living in times right now when a lot of people are referring the human woman's body from the top of the head to the toes as property, as, you know, the handmaiden's tale, where women, a lot of women are beginning to retreat. And I have to say, there's something about women who are able to financially drop off a kid and pick up a kid at school. Not everybody have that luxury or that luck or maybe that education or the good looks or whatever it takes to be a woman that's kept in a home where a man makes six figures plus, and you're able to drop your kid off, go to the gym, work out, and then pick. Not everybody had that. So what do you think is happening to the women who are just giving up and saying, well, if the politician wants it to be this way and they want to interfere in my right to choose when to have a child, if to have a child, when with whom to have this child, why are those women retreating?
Yeah, that's true. A lot of women don't get a choice these days. You know, my father, when I read just a little short snippet, my father used to always look at me and he would always say, but you can't do this because you're a girl. And when I graduated high school, I had dreams of going to Vanderbilt and going into medicine. And my father's like, those are great dreams. How are you going to pay for it? So I was thinking, you know, well, the bank of dad, who else is going to pay for it? And he says, I'm not paying for your college. He says, you're a woman. You're going to get married. You're going to quit school. And all my money's going out the window. So I had to put myself through college. And that made me very, very determined, very determined. And no one was taking that from me at all, ever. So whenever my father used to say something, the clause, but you're a woman, would come after it. Like, he did a lot in stocks. And I'm like, well, I got good in stocks because I learned from him. And he's like, no, you can't handle this because you're a girl. Or, you know, he had a plane. And he's like, you can't fly because you're a girl. And let me tell you, pigs could have flew out of me. I was going to do it before. I just was not going to give him the pleasure of me not succeeding on something because I was a girl. I got my pilot's license. Anything he said I couldn't do, I went and I did.
I love you. You're like what we need on a poster right now. I think Ali Tambor has a question for you.
Good morning.
Sure.
I was wondering what makes your books then different that's going to inspire women to maybe take the reins instead of backing back off?
Well, every one of my books has a woman heroine.
Yeah.
The woman's always going to be front and center in all of my books. And I do put a lot of truth in my books as well. You know, there'll be like, you know, prepper scenes that are actually, you know, spot on, or I always try to keep the science real as much as I can. But I always show the woman in lead roles. And that's a great way of learning because, you know, a woman might be reading and thinking, oh, geez, I can't do anything like this. But she reads my book and she's like, wow, this lady did it. Well, I guess I can do it too.
Yeah. And you said you most of your books are like dystopian novels. Our listeners here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends why you chose that word, because that word has a lot of meaning.
Yes, it does. That's actually a genre that used to be very, used to be absent, but now it's very, very busy. And the funny thing is it's male-dominated. There's me and I know another female writer, Jacqueline Durga, who writes the same, you know, the same genre. And, you know, you got to know these things. Nobody thought about it before COVID, but once COVID hit, people are like, oh, boy, we need to learn this, really. I mean, you need to know it.
Well, you know what? When I was reading your bio, I was thinking about zombies. You know how people, we had that show where people walking around aimlessly.
Skinwalker Ranch.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I swear to God, after we lived through COVID, anything is possible. Anything,
you know,
and everything is possible at this time.
You know, when I worked through COVID, I do a lot of research. I was on the New York City panel with John Hopkins. We were doing the study for COVID. But I was driving down the street one day, and it hit me. I saw so many ambulances along the road bringing people out. And where I used to live, there was a Muslim, it wasn't a funeral home. They arranged to send the remains back to Pakistan. But they had two big semi-trucks that took over the parking. It was on in Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn, and they had bodies in all of those two huge semis. I mean, they were semi-trucks. And they sat there for about 18 months before they finally closed it off and had the trucks taken away. And a lot of nursing homes, hospitals, a lot of neighborhoods had those big semis. And every time I drove by there, I'll tell you, my heart just broke. Because I had COVID too, and it was rough on me. it was very horrible. Very, very horrible.
So for our listeners who are tuning in, we're speaking with author Jenny Ahmad. So Jenny, you know, my husband's name is Ahmad.
Okay.
Yeah, yes. So I was like, oh, we have something in common there. And so for our listeners who are listening, Jenny is after her career as an ICU ER nurse, Jenny decided to put her experiences and knowledges into writing, and she has medical knowledge. You have law knowledge. You just about experience in every field. Now, Jenny, you live in New York City, and you have your own tribe, your many grandchildren and children. How do you find time to write doing all the things you do?
You know, it's really interesting. I don't sleep. I've been like this forever. When my husband and I got married, I think it's like 20 years ago, we were starting our business, and I would fall asleep at my desk over the keyboard. And as long as I have like 3 hours of sleep, I'm good. Maybe like once a month, I may take one day and just stay in bed all day. But my body doesn't require a lot of sleep. That's how I get it done.
Yeah, and you have a lot of hobbies too. You play violin. You're a pilot.
Yes.
You travel. Hands down, your favorite place in the world is sitting in an old town of Prague. So explain to me about that hobby.
Prague is in the Czech Republic. And there is this famous clock. It's called the Astronomical Clock. It's like maybe 7-8 stories tall. It was built in the 1300s. And the story behind that is very interesting. The clocks were maintained by a priest. And he was sequestered from everybody. His only thing he could do is with this clock. And any kind of maintenance or anything, that was the only person that was allowed to work on the clock. And when the priest was too old and could no longer maintain the clock, he was blinded so that he could never invent another clock or do another clock just like this. So on the hour and on the half hour, the clock comes alive. They have like the apostles going around in circles. There's two skeletons dancing, and it's really, really beautiful. It's amazing. I have it on YouTube.
How traumatic that someone had to be killed so we could enjoy that clock.
Well, they would live. It's just that they were made blind, so they couldn't build another one of those clocks. But it's really, it's one of the oldest clocks left in the world. And it's in the old town, and it's really nice. There's a nice little steakhouse right I don't want to say street because there's no streets, but right across one of the brick sidewalks. And when it's wintertime, they have the fires going. And I used to just love, that's my favorite place in the world. I try to go there once, twice every year. And I just sit there and I drink grog, and it's just so awesome.
So I misunderstood. So he lived, but he lived blindly.
But
right. Now Ellen's got a question. Ellen's got a question for you too about one of your hobbies.
Well, and just one comment too. That's the dystopia. The opposite of dystopia is utopia, right? So all of these stories, and especially the love for the clock too. It shows life after dystopia.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how people get through it.
Yes. Survival.
That's one of the thoughts behind the clock is like man has a limited time, and whether you're rich or poor, you're all going to die and everyone's going to have the same fate. That's the principle behind the clock.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. What a great story. So tell us a little bit about your collection is it Moser glass? And
yes,
Matryoshka dolls?
Yes, the dolls, those are the nesting dolls.
The ones that go inside each other. I'm showing Sita the...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
One goes into the next one.
I had a friend who came to visit us from Russia.
Nesting.
And they had brought me one, yeah.
They're amazing. They're so beautiful. And they're created, they're usually created in Russia. That whole little area, Russia, Romania, Czech Republic, Austria, not so much Austria, but those countries that are close to Russia, they make the dolls as well. One other thing that I have that's really amazing is the puppets, that you hold on with the little twig and they have
marionette.
The marionette, thank you.
Yeah.
There are 3 marionette theaters left in the world, and Prague has one of them. And I really love those marionettes.
A friend that put in an elevator in a building. He owned an elevator company and put an elevator in a building very close to where you're talking about that theater, that marionette theater, and told me that was like one of the things that was like a bucket list thing. Like you have to go.
Now, with all the trouble going on with our world, now you tell us about this beautiful place in Prague where we could travel, but with our U.S. passports, we have to make sure that we're able to come back home, especially naturalized citizens such as myself. You don't know if they're going to change up the rules. And I want to travel. I do. I've been to Turkey, Istanbul. I've been to Amsterdam and, different places, London, but I would like to visit some of those countries, like where you could go sit.
Czech Republic.
Czech Republic is beautiful, right? So before you go off air, tell us a little bit about where we can find your books, because there's so many of them. How many have you written? Because by the one by Dawn's Early Light has a lot of truth in it as well.
I just won an award with, I won a gold medal award on that book with Literary Titans, which is a worldwide contest. And I found that out last Friday.
Oh.
So that was like a, that was like
congrats.
Really exciting for me as well. But yeah, it's a process writing books, but I really enjoy it. I have three that are going to be coming out. I don't write just one book at a time. I write several at a time. You know, people say, oh, I got writer's block. So I'll come to a spot where I pause, and then I'll flip over to my next book and write till I have a pause, and then I go back to my first one because I'm always thinking. And the most amazing thing about writing is, you know, I come up with an outline, and my characters are going to do this and this and this, and I have an idea of where it's going to end. But I get to know my characters so well, and when I have an ending, this happened in my last book. When I had an ending, it's like, wait a minute, my character would never do that. So I changed my whole ending in my book.
So, and your books are available on Amazon?
Yes, they're on Amazon. They are in Barnes and Noble. They're online in like many, many, many stores. My website is Jenny, J-E-N-N-Y, Ahmed.com, and that can that'll click on to whatever websites you want to purchase your books at.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that your stories change as you write, because then you say, okay, this character can't do this. This character, so you have the outline, but you do change the storyline a little bit as you go along.
Oh, yes, definitely, because as you're writing, more things come to mind. And, you know, the book I have coming out now, that was a real challenge, because that one Yellowstone blew up, and my characters were stranded, and long story short, they get into, without giving you the storyline or the shocking ending, but they survive in a cave really deep. And my cave that I used is real. It's one of the longest caves in the world, and it just happens to be near Yellowstone. And so I had to learn a lot about what's in the cave. And so there was a lot of twists and turns, and then a real shocker with the cave. But, you know, it gets, you learn your character, but it's not just the character you have to learn. You have to learn your surroundings as well.
Yes.
You want to make that as real as possible.
Well, writing a book is sort of like a movie. You know, you're envisioning as I mean, you just said the word cave, and I'm envisioning like this long, winding cave with snakes and trees, and maybe there's
and
a pot with somebody making some curry chicken in there. Who knows? But
don't forget the bat.
Yeah. So what do you find is your favorite part of writing?
I like when I come to the end, because my ending is never the way I want it to be. And then after the ending, I always do a wrap up at the end of my book. And I tell the reader what was real, how I give them an idea of how they can learn more about this, whatever it is I'm writing about. And then, like I said, my hero is always a woman. And the woman's always doing something that can teach the reader something. So I like addressing that at the end so I can pass that knowledge on.
Well, we're grateful
them.
For that, because, you know, in today's world where we're watching what's happening, not just in the United States, but you read stories in places like Afghanistan where women can't
That's
go to school
true.
Past the age of 8, or you read stories about women who get married and forget their identity. And,
yep.
yeah, you know, they forget who they are. It's very, very important for us to relay that message to women and girls. And, you know, even in films, sometimes you see women portrayed as a sex object and not for her mind
That's
and
right.
her brain. And it does make you feel like here comes a hero, and Jenny Ahmed. And you're saying that my books, I'm going to make sure that the hero in my book, the heroine, is a woman.
Yes, my women in my books are very strong women, very strong women. A couple, I did one character who was my hero, but she wasn't a leader, and she had to develop that quality throughout the book. And she faced some moral dilemmas as well. That was, and she had, you know, how to work this out within herself. You know, she was forced to make a couple of really dangerous decisions that could have affected many people. And, you know, it was interesting that while I was having her make the decision, it was pouring all that data into her to debate whether she should do this or not. So,
well, we would love to have you back on the show another time, because, man, you do a lot of research as well for your books, and I see that, and you also have a degree in genetics. My goodness, Jenny, you're amazing. Yes. Well, we're going to have to end this segment, but before you go, I saw a meme when I was talking to you that day, and it says that God cannot be everywhere, so he sent mothers.
That's right.
Oh, amen. Wow, that's incredible. I like that.
Yeah, I thought about you and your books. Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Jenny, for sharing your wisdom. We'll make sure we get all of this great information out about where to find your books. I love the story. I love your whole take on all of this. We are going to take a quick break and listen to our sponsors, and we'll be right back after these messages with Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at Cloud9, that's Cloud9, furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000. Or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com. John Coff Financial Group.
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we...
Hold on a second. Well, hello there, listeners. We're back online. We're back online already. How you like? That's why we say our show is fun and unscripted. So our second segment today is with Mr. John. Is it Shavitz? I want to say it the correct way.
It is Shavitz.
Oh, Shavitz. See? How are you saying? And he's an LA-based writer and director. And we were just chatting with him while we were running our ads. And it's fine, Danny. It's good. That's why Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is a fun, unscripted, educational, and informative show. So, John, you are originally from Baltimore, Maryland, and you're known for crafting emotionally resonant stories. So talk to us a little bit about the depth of what you do.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, I've been working towards, you know, becoming a screenwriter and a director for about 20 years now. And really, you know, at the core of all storytelling, but especially, you know, movies and television, emotion is at the center of it. And, you know, in everything that I do, I try to tell emotionally authentic stories that people can relate to and that will resonate with them. It's a top priority for any storytelling, and that's what I really strive to do most.
Yeah, so the story that we you and I connected over was the one called Roses on a Vine, and I noticed that you've earned recognition for so many prestigious competition that you entered as well with your films. Talk to us a little bit about why this one was so special to you.
Sure, yeah. I mean, well, for one, it is my first feature film, you know, that is fully produced and completed. And getting that first one off the ground is, you know, for so many filmmakers, it's the biggest challenge of all. And so, you know, I'm very excited and proud that we were able to get it done. But yeah, I mean, on a very personal level, like, I think there aren't enough stories out there, especially in the film space, that, you know, deal with real people and real issues and real problems that people deal with every single day. And, you know, it's kind of it's just a major gap that's out there, you know, and I really wanted to do something that is different and, you know, like I said, speaks to not only, you know, the emotions that so many people deal with every day, but just the day-to-day grind, especially economic issues and single parenthood and, you know, just trying to survive and keep a roof over
your head. You're talking about, you know, real stories. I mean, you're talking about real life issues and you're pushing the boundaries while maintaining a very strong emotional core with your audience. And I like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thank you. You know, Roses on the Vine is really about a lot of things, but the center of the story is about a father and his bond with his 7-year-old daughter. And, you know, the things that he is willing to do and the risks that he's willing to take to, you know, support her and keep a roof over her head and maintain their relationship without, you know, falling into past mistakes and, you know, repeating, you know, patterns that have not served him well in the past.
Yeah. And I think the way you're doing this film, it's very thought provoking and it makes people think about what they're watching, what they're seeing, because like you say, it's happening to people in everyday life, and other writers and filmmakers are not interested in these stories because they want, you know, big bang and they want action and suspense and all that. But you're talking to people who wake up every day and have to face challenges and struggles just how to survive on this earthly journey that we all call life.
That's 100% true, you know, and in Hollywood, you know, there's been, you know, a sort of a longtime trend towards, I think they call it aspirational characters and, you know, sort of wish fulfillment and, you know, showing big superheroes and gigantic larger than life personalities, you know, that kind of transcend the everyday. And I think there's a good reason for that. You know, so many people watch movies because they're looking for an escape and they, you know, aren't really looking to experience their own lives when they're watching a movie. But, you know, I think that has created, you know, like I said, kind of a gap, you know, and there aren't enough stories out there that people can watch and say, okay, you know, I see myself in these characters. I can relate to this on a very deep personal level. And that's, you know, a big part of what we're trying to do here is show that, like, look, not everyone has to be a big superhero. We don't need big explosions and big car chases. We can just tell, you know, a grounded emotional story about people that are dealing with everyday issues. And, you know, hopefully people will be able to see themselves in it in a way that they can't in other movies.
So how this film you've got coming out now, that how it came to life? It's called The Creative Journey. Is that what it's called?
You mean just how my own creative journey on how the movie came to life?
Exactly.
Yeah. For sure. It's been a journey is probably an understatement. it's been a saga.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I started screenwriting when I was 19 years old, and I kind of just woke up one day and was like, oh, I want to spend my life making movies. You know, fast forward 20 years, and it's taken until now to get my first feature film done. And there's been, you know, lots of ups and downs along the way and a lot of exciting, fun experiences and working with big producers and, you know, at major studios, working with, you know, agents and A-list stars and everything is really kind of culminated in this moment where, you know, I finally have something that I'm proud of, that I'm, you know, putting out into the world, and I hope we'll find an audience.
So why this story of a single dad with his daughters? You had an aha moment. So tell our listeners, John, here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, about that moment when you decided that this is a story that I'm going to bring to life.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very specific point in time. I was home, I was looking out my window, and I saw, you know, a father and his very young daughter, maybe 6, 7, you know, years old, pull up to my building on a scooter. I think it was probably a rented scooter. And, you know, they were making a delivery for, you know, a food delivery app. And, you know, right away when I saw that, I thought to myself, okay, you know, there's a movie there. You know, these are obviously people that are, you know, trying to survive economically. And, you know, you could think of a million different, you know, reasons why someone might need to bring their child on their deliveries with them. But it is something that you see pretty often out here in LA. And, you know, when I saw that, I thought, gosh, you know, here's a guy who is, you know, trying his hardest to support his daughter. He's probably a single dad, maybe can't afford childcare, or, you know, and because of that has to bring his daughter with him. And I thought, wow, you know, you get this little six, seven-year-old girl hanging on the back of a scooter. it's just an indelible image that really stuck with me. And I thought, you know, this is a story that needs to be told, and a story that has not been told before, and something that I feel like.
And you thought that the dad probably had a checkered past as well. Your brain quickly said, single dad, no daycare, no money in the bank, no house, no land, and there's something wrong, you said, and it looks like the guy had a past as well. You put all of that together. You put all of that together by just watching them on the scooter fly by.
You know, this is kind of how my brain works, unfortunately.
No, it's fortunate. It's fortunate because that's so creative and so insightful.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is I definitely move through life, you know, observing and looking out for ideas that, you know, can inspire stories. And this was one of them, you know, and of course, like there's a fictionalization aspect to it. And I don't know this guy. I mean, he may not have a checkered past. He may have, you know, done things, you know, completely legally his whole life and never been arrested or whatever. But, you know, it was easy for me to imagine that someone like this could exist. Someone who has fallen through the cracks, lived on the margins, had to, you know, humble themselves and take, you know, risks and chances that other people may not have had to take.
Well, you just described almost everybody in L.A. When people go to L.A., you just made a tribute to the hardworking, beautiful, diverse people that live in L.A., and they are just so happy and take so much pride in being able to sacrifice, pay their rent, put food on the table, and get up the next day and say, I'm doing it.
That's life, right?
Yeah,
right? For how many people? For most people, right? It's just the daily grind, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, trying to stay above water and, you know, maintain your pride and your dignity in the process. It's just, it's a story that is absolutely the kind of thing that millions and millions of people go through, not just in the U.S. and not just in L.A., but, you know, everywhere across the world.
Okay, so let's transition really quickly. You wanted to talk a little bit about the production process and the challenges. You had a lot of challenges after the script was written. It was shot in 18 days, over 4 weeks in the summer, and it was during the strikes as well.
It was during the strikes, and the strikes almost, you know, completely made this impossible. You know, we had a 7-year-old actress and, you know, child actors have to go to school when it's not summer, or at least, you know, be with a studio teacher, you know, a certain minimum number of hours during the day. And we were kind of, you know, it was down to the wire for us. And, you know, we didn't know if, you know, SAG specifically was going to strike or not. And it was very precarious for us because we had to, you know, find locations and, you know, cast the film, do auditions, get our actors, all the pre-production leading up to shooting a film. And we were doing that not even knowing if we were going to be able to make it. And it could have gone one of two ways. It was either SAG, you know, decided to strike, and that would have been fine. And we, you know, that ultimately is what happened. And we got an interim agreement. We were able to work with the union, or they didn't strike. And obviously if they didn't strike, that would have been fine too. But what couldn't happen was, the negotiations getting extended even further. And they did get extended. And if they got extended any longer than they did, we would have still been in limbo. We would not have been able to get our agreement. And we probably would not have been able to make the film. So it was a very intense
time. But John, how exciting that you were able to have your dream come true, even though there was no AC. There were challenges with the sounds. You know, you had to get the birds and the wood chippers, the train sounds, the planes. But you know what? You did it. Your first feature film, you did it. We're so proud of you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It was a challenge, but it was a fun challenge. And it's everything I've been working towards my whole life. And, you know, I like to say shooting a movie it's the hardest fun you'll ever have.
Well, and that's one of the things that I wanted to ask about, John, was the, you know, most people are creative or they're business minded. And it seems to me like in filmmaking, you have to be both, right? You have to learn how to network to find the right people to be on your team, as well as creating all of the pieces and all the finer details of the filmmaking. So, you know, we kind of know now how you got into filmmaking, though, but what did you learn about making Roses on the Vine that you're going to carry into future projects? And what are some things that are up in the pipeline for you?
Yeah, well, you know, I so much. I think, you know, what I learned more than anything is just that on a very personal level, of course, I learned a lot about the filmmaking process and all of that, but really I learned about myself. I learned, you know, that spending, you know, well over a decade pursuing this was ultimately the right decision for me. And this is the work that I should be doing. And, you know, making a film and completing it successfully and having it turn out to be quite good is, you know, it's a validating experience for me, and, you know, really just sort of made me feel good about the fact that I've worked at this for so long, and it's just, it's a great accomplishment, and that it's going to give me confidence moving forward on, you know, my next project. Say, okay, I did it once, I can do it again. This is the work I'm supposed to be doing. And yeah, I got a lot of different projects on the horizon, working on a science fiction and romantic comedy that I'm super excited about. Have another, drama, kind of international thriller drama that I'm working on. And then I have a slate that's got probably 10 or 12 or 13 different projects in various stages that, you know, hopefully will keep me very busy.
So obviously moving from the East Coast to the West Coast was putting you in the right spot. Right, to be able to be able to move forward with all this probably a little bit faster. For someone that is aspiring right now, we've got a lot of colleges over here that are, you know, like, all of a sudden it escaped my brain, but there's one in Orlando.
That's, Full Sail.
You know, it's Full Sail University, absolutely. That does a lot of filmmaking. And so there's a lot of aspiring filmmakers out there and a lot of aspiring authors. What advice could you give them based on your experience? What advice could you give them about networking or about business side of it or about the creative side of it that would help a young, you know, possibly new filmmaker come out to L.A.?
Well, I'll try to give good advice as briefly and concisely as I can, because honestly, I could talk about this endlessly because it's not a straight line and everyone gets there in different ways. And it's super complex and complicated. And, you know, everyone's journey is different. But, you know, if you're a film student at, you know, Full Sail and you're living in Florida and you're learning the ropes and you know, learning production and how to tell great stories, and, you know, whether it's screenwriting or directing or producing or whatever, you know, part of the field that you're in. I would say probably the biggest thing is it really comes down to like grit and determination. The really sad thing that I see way too much is just people giving up too soon. I think there's a lot of, you know, people who expect sort of quick or instant gratification in life. And, you know, of all the careers you could choose, filmmaking is the one that, you know, takes absolutely the longest.
Well, you got to give it time, right? You know who you remind me of? There's a lady out in L.A. Her name is Jill D. A-G-N-E-I-C-A. Agneka? How do you say that last name?
Anika.
Anika. So Jill and I are friends. She used to live in the loft in L.A. next where my son lives when he lived in L.A. in that part. And Maggie Baird, who is the mother of Billie Eilish, she starred in a film that Jill actually made in 2013. And the film is called Life Inside Out. And Billie Eilish's brother is in that film, as well as the mom. And it was a lot of perseverance on Jill's behalf to make this film, Life Inside Out. And Maggie was her friend. They were really good buddies. So tell me, where did you find the cast for your film? Were these friends of yours, or did you have to go to a talent agency? Because, you know, we had Maggie call in on the show and Jill in 2013, and they talked to us in detail about Life Inside Out, and it was fascinating how that film came about.
Yeah, so casting is obviously super important. You know, getting the right actors is paramount to making a great film, and your actors are, you know, front and center. They have to sell your story.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very lucky. I have a very good friend, my producing partner, John Funk. He is also from Maryland. But, you know, we met very, very long time ago when I was working at a talent agency. And, you know, I approached him and said, hey, I have this script. I want to make it. I was really just looking for recommendations for producers. And he's a very smart, sweet guy and offered to produce it himself. And that was kind of a blessing. It was a huge blessing. But he has a friend, a very good relationship with a casting director, you know, who we went to and brought onto the film. And her name is Sarah Katzman. She's worked on a lot of big movies that you would know. And we were very lucky to have her. And she spearheaded the casting process and got us, you know, the perfect actors for our film.
How wonderful. You know, when you talked about emotional stories, it brought me back to you know, I'm a long-term care nurse. I've worked in our nation's nursing homes for over 36 years. And there was one particular patient that I always think about sometimes, you know, when I think about life and death and all of us leaving the planet one day. And she said to me one day, she said, I'm really concerned about my disabled son. She said, he lives in my home and he's on Medicaid. And after I die, I don't know who will take care of him. Because the older children wanted to sell that home after the woman passes, and she was concerned what would happen to that boy that lived in that house with her. And sure enough, she passed away, and the older siblings did come to visit us, and they told us they were selling the home. And I always wondered what happened to that disabled person, because, you know, we have social issues in our country, and we have certain things that we do for people because we have to take care of the disenfranchised and the ill and the children and the, you know, the disabled. But, you know, life, sometimes it does make you think about politics, and it does make you think about social issues. And then it makes you think of, then what? What's going to happen to this child, this man? And at that time, she was in her 80s, and the man was probably 70-something years old. So, you know, when you speak, I hope one day you could even do a story about something like that.
I would love to. You know, I'm definitely wired, you know, for storytelling that speaks to, you know, either the moment that we're living in or, you know, sort of the current temperature of society, and definitely social issues and economic issues and you know, it really adds weight to what you're doing because, you know, you're trying to get at something that is true and universal about life. It's really stories like that that oftentimes stick with us and resonate the most. So absolutely.
Yeah, or even, you know, like how you took this single dad on the bike. You know, I have stories of nursing assistants who come in to take care of our nation's seniors, and they don't know if they're going to have gas money for the next day. Because by the time mm-hmm. you pay your daycare and you pay your rent and you put food on the table, and then you have to come there with a smile and take care of somebody else's grandma, because that person is making $200,000 in New $200,000 plus in New York or Baltimore or New Jersey or wherever. But here you are in Florida, making less than $15 an hour to take care of somebody's loved one. And then you have politicians making rules and regulations for this person who's holding her head and saying, my goodness, I don't know if I'll be able to come in tomorrow because my tank is almost on empty.
It's a really harrowing thing to think about, you know, like imagine you're living on the sort of, you know, the edge here and, you know, you can't even put gas in your car to get to your job.
Yeah.
It's horrifying, you know, and it's something that I know people go through every single day.
Right. So that's the name of your next film. That's the name of your next film, Gas in the Car.
Gas in the Car.
So we have one minute left. We have 1 minute left. Where can people find a film and when is the trailer and the release details coming out?
So, there will be announcements. About where you can see it and when you can see it, and the trailer's coming soon. It's just about ready to drop, and we hope it'll happen in the next, you know, several weeks. If you're interested, you can go to rosesonthevinefilm.com. All of our socials are on there and a little bit of info about the movie. We hope you'll visit and check it out.
Well, we would love to promote it on our show as well, and Ellen here is a genius with singing, dancing, websiting, anything you think about, she can do it. So, John, I swear this was one of the best segments I've had. We like when people are trying to do great things for our world, our nation, people here in the United States, and do it through storytelling, film, and creativeness, right?
Yeah. And your story of perseverance, of, you know, sticking with a career that it doesn't always give you that immediate gratification like you had spoken about is just inspiring. So I hope everybody heard this segment. Of course, it'll be available on our website as well as on our archives as well with a picture, of course. We'll make sure we get pictures out there. Thanks again, John, for joining us here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Folks, tune in each and every Monday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida for Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We will see you next week.
Thank you, John. I'll keep up with you. I'll send you a...